So, youth culture and that much beloved phrase as originally kind of coined back at the end of the 19th century by a variety of journalists, including obviously pioneered by certain W.C. Stead, casting your mind back. And we have pretty much the working title for today's session. I want to start off, though, by considering the image that I've actually put up on the slide there, because this is a really important, significant factor when it comes to seeing the post-war situation in the latter half of the 20th century, and arguably even today when Donald Trump can go hand-in-hand with Theresa May into a whole brave new world, or maybe he's just worried about having to wash his hands. Anyway, World and Friend. That's the title of the front cover of this Time magazine. And you can see the planet Earth there, like a little baby, nice cherubic face, nestling in the arms of what we suspect, although it's never explicitly said, we can recognise as a well-known brand of fizzy drink that makes you burp. Yes, it could well be the Coca-Cola Corporation that's actually there suckling the Earth, the world, globalisation on its products. World and Friend is the subtext, with Love That Feeling and the American Way of Life. Time itself, of course, magazine formed in America, weekly news magazine, getting a message across there, an ideology that comes across in terms of the message that's being seen. And if you recall, last week we concluded with the image of Kennedy and Harold Macmillan, Kennedy pointing the way to the future, and Harold Macmillan, as the British Prime Minister, possibly wanted to be part of that really exciting, dynamic future and taking Britain into a whole new field. So let's consider some of the key elements that come across within this time historically. The Suez Crisis has passed. We've actually had the embarrassment of the Prime Minister, Anthony Eden, having to step down, and he's replaced by the aforementioned Harold Macmillan. Macmillan was Prime Minister between 1957 and 1963, and he was quite fortunate in a number of ways. He presided over a new era of consumer affluence. His nickname in the press was actually Supermac. We also have this phenomenon of the teenager. And the notion of the teenager appeared first in the United States. It was pretty much commonplace by the 1950s, or the mid-1950s, and it surfaced quickly in Britain. Okay? So if you want to trace the etymology of the word teenager to a particular time in history, you'd usually say middle of the 20th century, around about the early 1950s. The birth rate in Britain increased a little bit after the war, although there wasn't so much the baby boom that took place until the 1950s, and if anything, family sizes were small among the middle classes. They were also falling amongst the working classes. Children in the main were better fed, so they were healthier, they were actually taller than the war generation. They also reached puberty earlier than their parents had done, but they were also quite expensive to raise. Most children and families born after the war were likely to survive childhood. So there were also incentives not to have too many. You don't have to have the heir and despair, so to speak. In terms of what they were experiencing, well, working class children pretty much still played in the streets. Middle class children, on the other hand, would increasingly play indoors. Why? Because of worries about traffic, because of increasing house sizes as well. It was a lot more easier to actually stay indoors as opposed to playing in the street. Only the working class kids would actually play in the street and so on. Also, children were more likely to stay indoors because of the phenomenon of television. Right? TV, pictures, images. And televisions became increasingly common in households throughout the 1950s. As we said, there was the spike of interest in 1953, coronation of Queen Elizabeth. But after that, pretty much most households were having access to television and the networks of ITV, Commercial Network, and BBC television as well. BBC Two would emerge, as we'll see later, in the 1960s. It also is becoming increasingly common for children to receive expensive toys to play with. Not so much hoops, although that's an interesting demonstration of keeping people happy, but also even the less affluent working class folk would make an effort to buy new toys as they became available, and also as they were advertised to children. Television carries adverts for new toys which tie into TV shows, and so on and so forth, and comic books, and all those kind of things are part and parcel of the whole gender stereotypical age. Toys themselves tended to be gender stereotyped. Boys would be encouraged to buy train sets, matchbox cars, Airfix models of warplanes, in other words, anything to do with speed, battle, and travel. In the words of Dominic Sandbrook, girls had dolls, increasingly American-style dolls after Barbie appeared in 1959, skipping ropes, dressing up games, hula hoops, and tea sets. And boys, as I say, had the other mentioned things. Most children would receive pocket money to spend on sweets, comics, and toys. And so, in this halcyon post-war era of the 1950s, the next generation beginning to grow up and experience life and develop. What could go wrong? In addition to the notion of what they were spending as far as toys were concerned, comics and books for children would sell well. The comics themselves were generally also as gender stereotyped as well as the toys were. Stories of the intrepid wartime pilot Biggles by Captain W.E. Johns were primarily for boys. An author called Noel Stretfield was very successful with ballet and drama school stories for girls. A lot of the literature available for children in the 1950s primarily reflected an earlier time. There were boarding school stories that reflected the period of empire. There was general deference to adults. Team play, good manners, gender stereotyping, and inevitably some racism, with black characters inevitably turning out to be baddies, were part and parcel of the graphic narratives of the time. The quality of the writing was generally quite high, and the books are regarded as being classics of their time, but some of the ideas were still very outdated, and children generally liked them in any case. The Enid Blyton Famous Five, Secret Seven, and more kind of would emerge at this particular period in time. But, in the aftermath of the success of the huge American influence, the graphic narrative superhero characters of Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, etc. would also be percolating into the consciousness. Although there was a moment in the history of graphic narratives that was really significant in America, put together by a psychologist called Frederick Wertham, W-E-R-T-H-A-M. Wertham actually wrote a book called Seduction of the Innocent, and actually pointed out the connection between juvenile delinquency and the impression that was being developed by the superhero comic stories, etc., of super beings and so on. It also meant the demise of the EC horror comic strand. So there was a period in time there, which is an aside, that kind of meant there was an impact in terms of the way things were coming through. However, this image that we're seeing at present is one example of how an American approach was taken to revitalise the British comic book scene. And this clearly is an era pre-tablets, pre-video games. Television is actually there. Comic books are still very popular with children from 4 through 14, thereabouts. And comics were also very successful at getting children to part with their pocket money. The Eagle, as you can see there, appeared in 1950. It was slick, it was colourful, it was created by an Anglican vicar, and it was also meant to counter the supposedly violent and immoral American comics of the period. It introduced the world to the character of Dan Dare, Pilot of the Future, who still emerges. There's a recent radio series that's been developed with his faithful sidekick Digby, and other things. In other words, a classic stiff upper lift. Square-jawed hero representing Britain in the future, in the space age. Again, we're seeing that whole notion of the post-atomic age putting adventures into a whole new field. Dan Dare was effectively a pilot in space. It played to the wartime stereotype of a dashing, heroic airman, and other comic strips in the magazine featured heroes of empire, religious stories about St. Paul, It was focusing on a hierarchy, it was focusing on Christian values. Yes, it was very conservative, but it was very, very popular. In addition, it also told lots of wartime tales. Stories about the British Tommy versus the Hun were popular as well. On the other side, as far as girls are concerned, there we have a situation where, again, School Friend, Girl Comics and Bunty, which is, as I say, from School Friend, dealt with a variety of school stories. There were heroic women, there were historic figures, but these were part and parcel of the sort of young area that's coming through there. And if you have a look at the sort of the lines that are coming through there, I'm not sure if you actually see the actual text. But clearly you get a whole bunch of big silvery moon, it falls, a whole range of sort of aspects that are coming through there. It's re-emphasising and reprising the whole notion of a kind of traditional British view of life, which, as Orwell had obviously critiqued, was kind of out of touch with reality, but again, still was very much to the fore and was popular. Other girls, if you weren't interested in School Friends, might possibly go for the slightly racier Jackie or Mirabelle, sort of dividing the line, which obviously tapped into the growing popular culture movement and so on, and dealt with things such as romance, makeup tips, advertisements for clothing and cosmetics were popular. In other words, you could see that these were consumer guides for young people, for young females wanting to find the latest way forward, etc. These are sort of published really from the back end of the 50s to the early 60s, but Romantic Journey, the kind of popular pulp literature that sort of cheap entertainment for the average teenage girl. Education in the 1950s, 1953, the year of the coronation, it emphasised class. Also, reading materials impacted on class as well. The 11 plus was in force. In order to go to grammar school, you needed to pass the 11 plus exam. In the debate that still echoes in the present day, we still have this notion of where people actually go. Do you go to secondary one? Do you go to grammar? Do you go to comprehensive school education? And the return to the grammar school was a selection process. It was meant to effectively mean that those people who have the ability to actually pass an exam at the age of 11 could actually move on to the next stage of education and be basically groomed for higher education and university, or developed in that form. Whereas if you went to a technical or a secondary modern school, the general suggestion was you'd probably work in a factory or secretarial jobs or various other factors. And those who passed the 11 plus and went on to grammar schools tended to be middle class people. The other 80% of the population in terms of children would go to secondary moderns, and they were also perceived very much as being academic failure, or academic failures. If you failed the 11 plus, somehow, no, it must be a failure. It's all over. Equally, books by authors such as Enid Blyton were often seen by some as being working class and also common, even though they actually were emphasising middle class values. Other working class pastimes or nutritional elements which were seen as very much not appropriate: Spam, fish fingers, and comics as well. The school leaving age was 14, or in some cases 15. That was pretty much when you would leave school if you weren't pursuing an academic career and you wanted to actually get a job and so on. Grammar school pupils would tend to stay on until 17, or in many cases, as I mentioned, go into higher education. There was also a difference in terms of the resources. Grammar schools clearly had the best teachers, they had the best resources. And although some working class children did actually make it through the 11 plus, they found the middle class ethos quite difficult to adopt. Things such as reading books as opposed to watching television, attitudes to work and lifestyles, the kind of things that still echo today and get that schism between people who actually say, no, if I watch any television at all, it's just BBC Two, or maybe Channel 4, I don't watch any of the commercial stuff, etc. It's a definite split between the areas that you've got there. And higher education, which we're all part of today, continued to expand throughout the period. It's generally seen as a useful thing. It was a way of ensuring that Britain could compete on the international stage. All kind of important factors in terms of how education is developing and working in the post-war decades. Now, the government, who, if you recall, were predominantly conservative in the sort of post-1951 period, and throughout the 1950s, they hoped that this expansion of higher education would increase the numbers of scientists and engineers and make Britain more competitive on the international stage. Because it's a well-known fact that those students who actually study the sciences and engineers are infinitely preferable to students who might just go there to study the arts. In actual fact, students would prefer the arts and the social sciences by 100 to 1. For every one student who actually would go on to study mathematics or engineering, 100 would actually be pursuing English, history, arts, and so on and so forth. Journalism would not even be considered until the latter part of the century. Entrance qualifications were low, and that certainly fueled the teenage image, because actually it was in the art schools that American-style beatnik culture took hold. Cultural systems such as jazz, rhythm and blues would actually be permeating consciousness through the radio, through the television, through the cinema, through clubs and so on. And lots of students who would actually go off to art school and art college started forming bands. This was really the beginnings of what we'll go on to see was the foundation of the huge success of the 1960s. Lots of pop musicians from John Lennon, from Paul McCartney, from David Bowie, from Brian Ferry, and many more would actually begin their careers in that initial environment of art school environments and so on. Lots of designers, lots of artists would begin to emerge there. So although we've actually looked at the critique of the art schools, never underestimate their importance in terms of really boosting and providing a good bedrock for the national economy in culture and more. But then there's the other angle, which is national service. This was something that effectively everybody would engage with, every male over 18, except in special circumstances where they'd be exempted either for reasons of ill health or other things, would actually do a period of national service. And national service would actually continue for males well into the 1950s, actually up until the start of the 1960s it was in place. All 18-year-old men had to undertake 18 months' worth of national service. Actually, during the Korean War, you had to spend 2 years of national service. And that might mean you could be sent off to fight for your country in Korea or any other part of the globe, etc. As I said, it went on until 1960, and the last conscripts for national service finished their time in 1963. British troops were still spread thinly across the colonies, and the Soviet threat from the Cold War was considered very real. It was seen as something that clearly the World War III, or the likelihood of actually having another global conflict, was a clear and present danger. So clearly you need to have an armed forces that are actually ready to go, and lots of people who actually can go to fight on your behalf. But in addition to that, in addition to the fear factor, national service was actually deemed to be a good thing. It gave people the opportunity to actually go and promote unity, to promote patriotism, to promote discipline and team play among young men who otherwise might have just been completely lost in life. Again, it's often a well-held refrain, I'm sure you will have heard, bring back national service, bring back some sort of national service. And it's fair to say that some people really enjoyed their time as national service. Others didn't, they hated it. So the experience could be very diverse. Some folk never left the country, others would see action in different parts of the world, maybe even Suez. Some would enjoy the comradeship and mature, others were just frightened. You know, why, if you're not really into war, why would you want to actually suddenly be parceled off at 18 to have to do 2 years or 18 months minimum in the armed services? However, when people start to complain about the rise of teen culture, they regularly blame the ending of national service for some of the worst effects and impacts. Disaster. No uniforms, problematic issues, and a whole range of folk just going to heck in a handbasket. In the 1950s and 60s, teenagers certainly became much more prominent in the media. Because they were more affluent, there was a whole network of manufacturers, of retailers, of publishers who would spring up directly targeting each and every teenager in the country. Now, they weren't particularly influential. There was a notion in some historians' work that somehow the teenager changed the world. Well, not really, but most of society at any one time was comprised of teenagers or young people and adults and a whole range of things, much as it is in the present day. And teenagers equally are not a coherent group. You can't say every teenager actually sort of fulfills these particular criteria, because they don't. You know, in this room you have a whole diverse selection of tastes, views, aspects. You know, teenagers would actually, some would be at work, some would be divided by class, some would be divided by region. You know, northeasterner, completely different from a southerner. Regions would be different, outlooks would be different, ages would be different, tastes would be different, etc. So you couldn't necessarily turn around and say, there's just one size fits all. However, what, as we said, did teenagers, as opposed to children, spend their pocket money on? Now, consider a few years before this particular image is taken, and the start of the late 1950s, these people might have been playing in the street, might have been watching television, all sorts of other areas there. Teenagers spent their pocket money, or money from jobs, obviously they're pretty much plentiful, on pleasure. And why wouldn't you? Clothes, records, magazines, snack foods, cinemas, dance halls, cosmetics. All the big sales aspects in terms of, you know, what you do. You don't have any family commitments or family connections, or hopefully you haven't, so you can effectively decide what it is you want to spend your money on. Looking at the actual figures, there's an estimated 5 million teenagers by 1960 in Britain. That's worth about 5% of all consumer spending. So it's not a huge amount, but it's a significant amount. 5 million teenagers spending about 5% on consumer matters. And that actually meant, in terms of all consumer spending, you're spending about £830 million in a fairly narrow market. Because what magazines, cosmetics, snack foods, cinemas, dance halls, etc. don't actually have, they're not hugely expensive purchases. They're not houses, they're not appliances, washing machines and so on. They're not the kind of the big earners in society. And, you know, if you're a teenager, why would you want to necessarily buy a house or appliance or so on? The general notion was most teenagers would, understandably, be more impressed in impressing their peers and hanging out in coffee bars than actually worrying about, obviously, having to buy a dishwasher or some such. In terms of the actual breakdown of what that £830 million was spent on by the 5 million teens in Britain, well, a third would spend it on bicycles and motorbikes, a third would be spent on cosmetics, and the remaining third on records and record players. Products were preferred that were generally emotionally charged. A sense of vinyl, absolutely, you know, the latest vinyl record, and the latest Elvis Presley track, the latest Bill Haley, the latest Chuck Berry, etc. They were modern products. They were exciting. Emotionally charged, modern goods, exciting. What does that tie in with? It's American. It has to be. Buy America. Buy America. This impacted on an awful lot of the more middle-class perspectives within Britain. There was a general sense of shock that American consumer values were sucking in the young generation of Britain. Now, even here, sort of the attitude, trench coats, etc., sort of the attitudes rebel without a cause, the images that are coming through with that whole basis. What's happening to society if you're simply imbibing, like we saw in the first slide, just uncritically all American culture? And that can actually run from Western starring John Wayne, movies starring Marilyn Monroe, musicals, a whole kit and caboodle, everything that's sort of there, sort of cultural domination. And unlike other parts of Europe, we can't say we don't speak English, we don't speak American, the language is the same, so it obviously opens its way up for potential cultural domination. Lots of people were shocked to find American consumer values were taking part in this area, and there was also plenty of work available for the young. This work was relatively well paid and also allowed that disposable income to be used as and when teenagers saw fit. So, how do we get from there to moral panic? just a reminder there. Well, how do we get from there to moral panic? Well, as we said, people had left school at a relatively early age. Working class, lower middle class would tend to begin work in the ages 15, 16 and so on. They also tended to have tedious jobs. They'd also start spending earlier on things like radios and records and so on. Middle and upper class teenagers' education, as we said, were more likely to go to art cinemas and jazz clubs. And teenagers, as noted, were a fairly diverse group with diverse tastes. The visible teenage culture in the 1950s was primarily working class. Dance halls, jukeboxes, motorbikes, pop singers, all mostly associated with young working class men. And as early as the late 1940s, the Daily Mail, God bless them, is describing teenagers as hoodlums, and teenage girls as brazen consumers of trashy films and fashions. And the 1950s youth becomes a big issue, and the media launches a number of moral panics related to youth delinquency, violence, social deviance, and so on, all mostly aimed at the working classes. Again, just a reminder of what we considered last year. This is where we start developing this. What's the threats to everyone else? Working class teenagers. Why? Because they've got time on their hands and they're hiding around the streets. They're clearly unlike us because they're younger than us and they're also wearing American fashion. All you need is a couple of stabbings and suddenly there's a threat. Exaggerated and so on and so forth. All of these kind of key areas that emerge in terms of that creation are epitomised in this period of the 1950s and, as we'll see, the 1960s as well. Now, as we said, this idea of problems with youth is not new. It goes back to the 19th century. Young people tend to be categorised as being noisy, promiscuous, inexperienced, self-centred. Well, that's what young people have actually done, particularly in a consumer-based society. Look at them. Would you actually want to have your daughter go out with one of these young people? Unbelievable. Although they're probably in a care home now. It's just a thought. Anyway. In terms of the sort of visible images that young people actually said, certainly these are an example of the folk devils of the 1950s. They are, in case you haven't recognised them, the Teddy Boys. Teddy Boys had long greased hair worn in a quiff. They wore colourful shirts and suits that in some ways were also based on Edwardian fashions. But they were also Americanised as well. Now, Teddy Boys as a fashion statement were primarily a working class fashion based in South London. But the clothing was very expensive. This is in a period where rationing has just come to an end. This is going to cause offence. We're living in times of austerity. You're wearing all these flashy Teddy Boy outfits. You're flashy material. This is causing offence. You shouldn't do it. The look itself also became quickly associated with violence and gang fights. Again, nothing new from that perspective. The working class youth had been seen as drinking and tooling up with bike chains and knives and fighting for generations. But when the Daily Mail and other media put a spotlight on it, it suddenly becomes something to be seen as a threat, as an image that's actually to be worried and feared about. Again, a relatively short-lived phenomenon which died out in the mid-1950s. There are tales of people going to see Bill Haley and the Comets rock around the clock at a cinema and ripping up the cinema seats and knifing and then all sorts of outrageous behaviour and so on. Teddy Boys tend to be associated with rock and roll, but actually the fashion for Teddy Boys died out before rock and roll as a phenomenon really arrived in Britain. Again, it was an austerity thing, and austerity was certainly gone before Elvis Presley had his first number one record. Now, looking at the figures, there's no doubt that juvenile crime and violence continued to rise in the 1950s and beyond. And from 1955 to 1961, the number of teenage boys convicted of serious offences doubled. Nobody actually really knows why, but there's still a sensitive subject that's actually at the heart of the whole thing there. Here's an interesting one in terms of, I always feel this chap in the middle is completely out of it. You know, he's trying desperately to actually have his jacket and all the rest of it. She doesn't care at all. She's just given up completely. And the sort of attitude there, saying, yes, but there's that disconnect, the traditional stoic sort of values, motorbikes, leather jackets, etc., etc., connections from that. actually the vast majority, and I emphasise that, the vast majority of teenagers were not as violent or rebellious as newspapers, and indeed some historians have actually suggested. Teenagers would tend not to get involved with politics. What happens about Suez? They don't care. It's not interesting. It's boring. They weren't really idealistic. We certainly didn't develop a kind of equivalent of a Hitler Youth that was developed here in terms of, you know, focusing ideologies, or indeed, as would happen in China, sort of Mao Zedong cultural revolution. If you actually conducted surveys, many students would actually claim that they were quite conservative. They'd also claim to be anti-American, even though they might buy a lot of American products. They would actually say, verbally, they were anti-American, and they were simply not very radical. And even during the most frenzied bounce of moral panic in 1956, and as we'll see in a few moments, 1964, most teenagers simply weren't involved. Most of these folk didn't want to kill anybody. They didn't want to save the world. They just wanted to spend some money. So why have we got this nostalgia? What about the Teddy Boys? What about the rock and rollers, the mods and rockers and so on, which again we'll consider at other areas? Well, again, it seems to have been the media and the police that effectively turned these young innocents into folk devils. Disaster. According to Stanley Cohen, who was the author of a book called Folk Devils and Moral Panics in 1972, teenagers in the 50s and the 60s formed into subcultures. Those subcultures were things like the Teddy Boys, the mods, the rockers. In other words, they were groups, they were tribes, if you like, who were united by fashion and music. They also rejected, in the main, the values of mainstream society. We'd see this with the hippies in the 1960s, the punks in the 1970s. So on and so forth. That's a general theory that Cohen put forward to, but it's something which isn't accepted by everyone, as you might expect. Academics have different views, and Dominic Sandbrook, as I mentioned, if I had one book that I'd say if you want to access for this text, as I've talked about seminars on Monday and will later on today, I would say Dominic Sandbrook's White Heat is the go-to text for this. He actually argues that mainstream values were never that clear. So there wasn't the dominant ideology that really went through this. And it's too easy to say, oh, it's A leads to B, leads to C, leads to F. Sandbrook maintains that most of this was a creation of the press rather than something that one could react against. Is this a riot? Maybe, maybe not. It's one individual who might have actually sort of been, you know, offensive or whatever, is being led away on the seafront by the police officers and so on. But if you've got those small groups that can be made very prominent, obviously the press and the mass media can impact that whole element. So, where do we go to from that particular perspective? How do we move from there to that? Oh my God, they're throwing deck chairs now. It is very serious. Teenage crime obviously is on the increase. Teenagers are also more sexually mature. It's all right when they're actually just reading comics and books, but when they can actually reproduce as well, This is getting worrying. And in 1964, some fighting broke out between the mods and the rockers at various seaside resorts over a bank holiday, most notably in Clacton and Brighton. Now, bearing in mind this is 1964, a year after the Cuban Missile Crisis, which is kind of more significant, possibly, or arguably, on the basis of bringing the world to the brink of nuclear Armageddon because of Soviet missiles placed in Cuba. However, in 1964, as noted, fighting broke out among the mods and rockers at various seaside resorts over the bank holiday, and the BBC reported thus. Mods and rockers jailed after seaside riots. Scores of youths have been given prison sentences following a Whitsun weekend of violent clashes between gangs of mods and rockers at a number of resorts on the south coast of England. Yesterday, two youths were taken to hospital with knife wounds, and 51 were arrested in Margate after hundreds of teenagers converged on the town for the holiday weekend. Dr. George Simpson, chairman of Margate Magistrates, jailed four young men and imposed fines totalling £1,900 on 36 people. Three offenders were jailed for 3 months each, and five more sent to detention centres for up to 6 months, and so on and so forth. The Evening Argus, the Battle of Brighton. 50 arrested. Two stabbed in Margate flare-up. 17 more die on the roads. Special offer, the elite electric sink water heater, only £19.10. you're really ramping up this whole notion of a desire. Battle of Britain, it's hardly the Battle of Britain, but again, you've got a few people there, say 50 arrested. So, Margate again, as we said, running battles between the police, up to 400 youths on the beach were arrested and so on. Moving on, Wild Ones invade Seaside, 97 arrests. There we are, it's the Daily Mirror from March the 30th, 1964. It's got to be serious, we've got to get the dogs out from that point of view. The Wild Ones invaded a seaside town yesterday. 1,000 fighting, drinking, roaring, rampaging teenagers on scooters and motorcycles. God help Burnley, that's all I can say. But anyway. By last night, after a day of riots and battles with police, 97 of them had been arrested. Sunday joint saved by wives. And the Easter miracle of Alaska. Fewer than 100 die. Yeah, it's nothing new. It's something, you recognise this by looking at the red tops in terms of the agenda today. But in terms of getting the message out that there is a panic that's happening here, it's significant. And it's one of the reasons we're spending a little time today actually focusing on this. As we noted, it's nothing special or unique. Total number that were involved, maybe a couple of thousand youngsters. A couple of thousand youngsters who basically didn't have anything to do. Well, of course not. National service had been ended. They converged on the seaside together with many thousands of ordinary families, and this was massively exaggerated in the press. The Birmingham Post editorial in May 1964 warned as follows, that mods and rockers were internal enemies in the United Kingdom who would bring about disintegration of a nation's character. Strong words in terms of what's being seen as being presented here. And the magazine Police Review argued that the mods and rockers' lack of respect for law and order could cause violence to surge and flame like a forest fire. The author Brian Wilson argued that the supposed teenage problem related to problems in the wider society. Society is changing. Visible teens and visible teenagers, they've got attitude. They have attitude. They clearly actually can impact and become a symbol of the changes and insecurities of the period. We're now kind of getting to the period of almost two decades after the end of the Second World War. We're into the 1960s. Obviously, these blokes have found it just far too much. He can't. Ironic indeed, if he was the bespectacled chap that we saw earlier, looking at the whole thing. No, he isn't. That's an interesting narrative to draw through that whole little storyline there. But society is changing. What we're seeing is the notion of, technology is impacting. We're getting rid of rationing. There are definite signs of improvement. But it's what do you do with your life? Where there is choice, there is misery. In many ways, the newly affluent teenager often didn't have the education and the information necessary to cultivate their own tastes and their own activities. They might not necessarily like everything American. They might have actually liked the music of, the rock music industry or popular culture and so on, but they didn't know what to actually do with their time from that point of view. It is inevitable that they would be commercially exploited. They would be the victims of ephemeral and not very satisfying fads. The Kinks, dedicated follower of fashion. You choose to do this not because you actually have any particular belief in the ideology, but because it's what everybody else is doing and you don't want to stand out. You don't want to kind of be seen as alien from that point of view. You want to sort of maintain some kind of uniformity after fashion with what you're involved with. And in Britain as a culture, you're also seeing some significant changes. People are questioning the status quo. They're questioning the established order, the notion that actually you should always defer to authority, whether that authority is parental authority, whether it's institutional authority in the form of doctors, in the form of health, in the form of educators and so on, in the form of the police. There was clearly a sense that asking the question why was a very dangerous one to put together. There was an instability of the family and the community. Smaller families, more extended families. Last week, if you recall, big changes in housing. People were no longer living in an environment where you had the communities where the rosy glow, being able to step into your neighbour's front living room, etc., was a standard sort of way things. There were housing estates being set up. new values and so on. And also, there was a suspicion of America and what were the values and products that became associated with the teenager, but ultimately were affecting everyone. Teenage culture didn't actually challenge the mainstream, but it was a sideshow, and it was a very important sideshow in a period, as we'll go on to see, of immense social change. Thanks for your time, and I'll see some of you later on in seminars and others on Monday. Make sure you sign the register as well.